Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, this is a college football podcast, as everybody knows, but man, it is college basketball's on the brain this week. March Madness, great opportunity, by the way, to subscribe to The Athletic. It's only $1 a month right now. Dollar a month if you subscribe to The Athletic, and clearly you're going to want to get your March Madness expertise from Seth Davis and Dana O'Neill and Brian Hamilton, and not the two of us.
No, I think we're pretty devoid. I think, I don't know if we ever had much expertise on the college basketball front, but if we did, I think it kind of fizzled out back in the days when Mike Bray was a hot coach. So,
I mean, I was still doing bracketology as recently as 2018, so I did know something at that point, but I'm having to read up myself on this season. But, you know, we actually, so on today's episode, we're having on Brody Miller, our excellent LSU writer, because there's just been so much going on involving LSU football on and off the field. And then we're going to take some mailbag questions. And one of those mailbag questions allows us to, we didn't expect to do this, but we went on quite a trip down memory lane about some of our favorite March Madness memories, some of which don't actually involve the basketball games.
Let's get to Brody.
All right, we're pleased to be joined now by our excellent LSU reporter, Brody Miller. Brody, we wanted to have you on because obviously LSU's been in the news a lot lately. Not very much good news, which kind of, I feel like, continues the theme of the last, 14 months or so. I wanted to get kind of your big picture perspective first before we get into some of the details here, but like, how long ago does the 2019 undefeated season feel like at this point, if you're around LSU?
It feels like a very long time ago, and I'm sure it does to Ed Orgeron and everybody involved, too, just because, yeah, it's been like a cascading flow of just, you know, rough news from, you know, the pandemic hitting to then all of a sudden you got, you know, those players only protests, and those maybe didn't go exactly well for, you know, O and the staff. And then you have the rough season, the Pelini hire bombing, and now you have a massive, you know, handling of Title IX issues scandal going on here. So it's just it seems like every day, you know, for the past year and a half, it's just kind of been negative news. So I think, you know, spring ball started yesterday, and quite frankly, just the idea of like talking about something promising, you know, for Orgeron and all that, and just talking about football, you could just tell they are so happy to have something else to talk about and talk about, you know, trying to get back on track, because it has been a brutal year and a half. You put it well,
Brody. So as they go from a 15-0 national title season to a 5-5 season of all SEC games, where do you think we're going to see from LSU in 2021?
You know, it's tricky, right? Because it's not like talent was ever the problem. Like, yeah, I mean, of course, they weren't experienced last year, and that's a very reasonable excuse, I think, in the SEC West to some extent. But it's not like it was like, oh, LSU wasn't talented. The talent's still good this year, just like it was last year. So it's almost not fair to be like, well, they're good enough to win, because they were good enough to win last year. And I think when you look at it from that perspective, but you add the experience, I think they have 32 guys, I think, will be on the roster this fall, who started games at one point last year. You have your entire offensive and defensive lines back, good quarterback depth, like all the pieces in a vacuum are there to be, you know, maybe not title good, but, you know, top 10 in the country good. It's there, but it's always there. And I think the hope is, one, the experience, that's a huge positive, you know, but also the idea that, quite frankly, you know, at least defensively, from a staff point of view, I mean, it was, I think most of you guys know me pretty well. I'm not somebody who talks in extremes. It was kind of incompetent last year at times. So, you know, getting rid of Bo Pelini and bringing in Durante Jones, getting rid of, you know, Bill Bush and bringing in Blake Baker, guys like that, you know, there's a little hope that just having competency there, having a roster that knows what they are doing and can just communicate at a baseline level, combined with having all the talent they always have, that, yeah, you should go from 5-5 to, at the very minimum, 9-3. So there's a little bit of sense of, it's not like 2019 where you needed some like Joe Brady reinvention of the offense or something like that. It's just getting to a place of general, knowing what you're doing, there's no reason this team can't be really good. So my prediction is, yeah, I mean, when you look at, you know, it's a good year for the schedule, things like that, this team should be 10-2 good. It's just it's almost unfair to just like assume that because they should have been 9-3 good last year.
I don't know. You referred to it earlier, but I don't know how much people outside of LSU fans realize the extent of what happened before they even started the season last year in terms of some things that Ogeron did that did not go over well with the players. And now that you've had some time to some distance from it, I mean, how much we knew that with the turnover last year, they probably would take a little bit of a step back, but how much of it was more the events of last summer?
Yeah. You know, and I mean, I think Bruce knows this even better than I mean, I think Ed Ogeron's a pretty apolitical person. I do not think Ed Ogeron is somebody who was like having political beliefs that, you know, and feel like it wasn't like a Mike Gundy situation, right? I believe Ed Ogeron is somebody who was just like, hey, Donald Trump was good to us. And he went on Fox News a bunch because he was doing a lot of PR with wearing masks. And he was doing a good job in the pandemic of trying to be a positive voice and things like that for PSAs. And he kept going on Fox News. And they kind of pressed him over and over again to be like, yeah, you love Trump, right? And I just don't think Ed Ogeron really like thinks that deeply about politics, and quite frankly said, yeah, I love President Trump. And apparently they had other conversations outside of that. And, you know, with everything going on last summer with, you know, equality and different, you know, issues with the police, you have a locker room that does not think very fondly of President Trump. And then all of a sudden you have a coach, you know, Ed Ogeron, who says, yeah, I love him. And, you know, this isn't about what anyone's political belief is. It isn't about what mine is. It's just the idea of, you're a coach of a locker room full of primarily, you know, over like majority black men, and they feel like when you say that, you're saying you don't think they deserve equality, and they you don't see their side of these things. And there was frustration, and then, you know, then there's frustration. They had a meeting, and maybe didn't handle that meeting perfectly, and you know, I think that just led to a, I don't think it was like a broken locker room, but there was some animosity there and some tricky things mixed in with the pandemic where everything's already weird anyway. And Bruce, you know, if you disagree, you know, if you have anything to add, you can jump in. But I just think it was a situation where it was a lot of just a mistake he made that. And I think Ed Ogeron, one thing I always give him credit for is I think he's better than anybody at learning from his mistakes and making changes. And I think the fact that he was able to keep all these seniors this year and all that shows he at least made some good leaps in terms of winning that locker room back. But I do think that was a factor last fall. Absolutely.
Brody, what do you think going forward? So, most teams typically change personality or aren't the same personality every year in the locker room. Pretty much everybody in the offensive and defensive lines stayed and ended up coming back. Jacoby Stevens, who was a leader on the team, he's moving on to the NFL. Jabril Cox, who was there for 1 year, he's moving on to the NFL. Terrace Marshall is. But by and large, except for those three guys, I feel like most of the locker room seems like it is the same guys. From what I understand, Damone Clark has taken on more of a leadership role. There's a few other guys I've heard seem to have been more, become more vocal. Has this been a 2.0 version, or is it just different voices have emerged? Or like one thing I do think was going to happen was this isn't, LSU was not Alabama where players got used to playing for playoffs and in national titles. I think for some of them, it was like, hey, we won a national title. Like, we accomplished what, you know, we hadn't accomplished here in a long time. And they turned the page, and you ended up with a very different dynamic on that team. So where is it now? Because for the most part, the guys who are going to be starters and leaders, they really, even if they were on the roster, with the exception of, like, Austin Deculus, I don't know how many of those guys actually played much in 2019. So with all the things that, you know, we've talked about on this, like, where do they go with that, I guess, is what I'm curious about. Does it feel like it did in 2018, which was like the precursor to 2019, where they came off of a really messy, not as messy as certainly 2020 was, but it was a messy 2017. So where is it from your read on the situation?
Yeah, and to go back to something you were saying in there too about, you know, a lot of these guys, there was kind of a weird thing that happened when they won a title and then the next group just kind of, and so many guys were gone. And I go back to something the 30-year-old punter Zach Von Rosenberg said last year, which I think nailed it on the head. And he talked about how, okay, that 2019 team, that was built on guys who had been there, and, you know, your Clyde Edwards-Helaires, your Joe Burrows, your Patrick Queens, guys who, like, put the work in, were grinders, guys who, like, really got, like, pushed themselves to get where they were, spent absurd amount of time in the film room, perfected all these things to get there, and they learned from the guys above them, you know, your Devin Whites or whatever. And there was this culture of, like you said, you know, you worked your way up from 2017's disaster, 2018, 2019. There was this, like, sweat equity involved in that building and guys learning how to do it the right way. And then all of a sudden, And I go back to something Tom – it kind of connects to something Tom Allen talked about, I think, when talking about losing a bowl game and skipping a step, right? And you don't want to skip a step in your building your infrastructure. And all of a sudden, they won this title and you lose, right, like we all know, like 19, 20 starters, and all of that infrastructure is gone. And all of those guys who knew those lessons we just talked about and would normally be the seniors teaching you about how to put that work in and what it takes to get there – that was suddenly gone in your roster. Like, obviously, there were a few, like you mentioned a few of them, but it was mainly a roster full of guys that weren't actually the guys winning the title and didn't really know what that kind of thing took. But like you're saying, I'm not saying there was an arrogance, but maybe there's a little bit of you're acting like you just won the title, but you weren't the guys putting in that work and you never learned how to put in that work. And Zach Von Rosenberg talked about that at length with us, about how they had to relearn. Like, they just didn't have that last fall. And I think that was a huge part of the problem. And now you go through 2020's disaster. Disaster. And, you know, I'm not comparing it to 2019. In no world would I ever compare it to 2019. But the one thing 2019 had going for it also was, like we said, it was guys who had been through 2017 and 2018. They were experienced and they had this chip on their shoulder. And I think that, to get to your overall question, there's a little bit of 2021 right now. It's experience, but it's guys who have something to prove. Guys who are mad about the 5-5 season. Guys who are embarrassed. Guys who have the, like, who, I mean, you have a coach who, you know, has a little bit of pressure on him. You have players who people don't think are good. So there's a little bit of that culture going on, I think, this spring, where it's like no one's arrogant. Nobody's thinking they've earned anything because they just went through the worst season in 25 years. So I think that's a little bit of the culture. And I think you're seeing your Andre Anthony's a big guy who stepped up as a leader. I've heard really good things about Ollie Gay. I've heard really good things actually about Miles Brennan this spring. And I thought it was interesting. One thing Jake Peets, the new offensive coordinator, apparently brought over from he learned from Clemson, I believe, was kind of basically that they do a vote on the team of like the five guys that, you know, really represent LSU best and the guys that the five that are the worst. And, you know, I'm not going to say maybe the guys who are the worst right now, but you know, some of the guys I've heard that represent the best were Ollie Gay, Andre Anthony, and I heard Miles Brennan. I'm forgetting some others, forgive me. But that's big because Miles Brennan's not a guy I think anyone would have thought of to be voted by his teammates for that a year or two ago. So things like that are big, and you do have a little bit of that more you-have-to-earn-it mentality, and I think that's got to be the bedrock of this program right now.
By the way, that Tom Allen reference that Brody made was no coincidence. He is an IU grad and easily the biggest Indiana football fan I know. He's probably, for all I know, right? Are you in a Tevin Coleman jersey right now while we're talking to you?
Okay, I always have to clarify. This is a tricky thing ethically because my IU football fandom was always sarcastic because they were bad. Like, it was like I never felt like it was pushing an ethical boundary because they were so bad it was like a joke. And now they're good, and it's like, shoot, this probably isn't a good look for a reporter to be like a known IU football fan, but man, I'm enjoying it.
I think it's fine. You cover, maybe if you were covering Purdue, that might not go over so well, but you cover the SEC.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Turning to a more serious topic, I know, as much as Coach O would love us to not talk about this anymore, I mean, the Title IX story isn't going anywhere. USA Today, for one, continues to shed new light, even beyond the 200-something page report. that the law firm came out with. There was some video I saw, you know, I think maybe the day after or 2 days after, of students. So basically, their students weren't happy because after all that, after all these instances in that report of the school not taking Title IX cases seriously enough, or in some cases just failing to report them, the only discipline that came out of it was two officials, Virge Osberry, who's worked in that athletic department for a long time, and Miriam Seeger, were suspended, one for 30 days, one for 21 days. Nobody was fired or anything to that extent. So the video I saw was students who were protesting, who were literally blocking anybody from getting in or out of the parking lot of the football building, players coming to and from, coaches, whatnot. So, I mean, while that story doesn't, you know, involves players that are long gone and doesn't implicate, I believe, anybody within the football program itself, like, it's right there in their faces. You know, is this, you know, how much is this still kind of hovering over them right now?
It's absolutely still hovering over them. Like you said, there was that protest where players couldn't leave the facility all day, you know, that was last week and things like that. And I think there's a lot of anger because, first off, you start with, like you said, the punishments and the fact that the two people that were absolutely at the center of this, Virge Osberry and Miriam Seeger, were not punished much, hardly at all. And you know, and it's like, you know, that's not really going to discourage anybody. You know, I think a lot of, and those are issues. And then there's another part of this that I always feel like it's worth kind of starting with whenever discussing it, is the fact that there are a lot of victims and a lot of lawyers who have come out saying they tried to talk to Hush Blackwell for more, to tell them more, and they didn't talk to them, or that, you know, there was maybe some, not some efforts, you know, there was a limited scope maybe to the investigation. And when you look at the investigation, and by the way, this isn't even a criticism of Hush Blackwell, because I think they did a very good job of what they were assigned to do, but it was focused exclusively on the USA Today, on basically it dove into only the reports that USA, the incidences that USA Today brought up, right? It dove into those, but it didn't really make an effort to find new instances. You know what I'm saying? So I think there's a lot of frustration from victims who didn't feel heard, that felt like, you know, they didn't look into areas that they told them to look into. There's a lot of frustration from people like that, that maybe this was a limited scope and almost like a half gesture to show you're doing the due diligence, but maybe not doing it. And I think that's where some frustration lies. And then you combine that with nobody was really punished. And yes, of course, and it is worth mentioning that, like you said, you can't punish people who aren't there anymore. Joe Oliva is not there anymore. Former President F. King Alexander is not there anymore. And by the way, literally as we speak right now, there's a board, Oregon State where he's at right now, a board of supervisors meeting discussing whether he should be fired from Oregon State. And you can't fire Les Miles, but Kansas did, you know? So everywhere else is punishing people, and LSU, those people are gone, and then the only two that were still there weren't even really punished. I think that's a tough thing for a lot of people to wrap their head around. And, you know, the issues are more complicated, though, than just some actor, you know, doing something bad. It was a system designed of, hey, LSU Athletics, we do not report things to Title IX. We report them to Miriam Seeger, Virge Osberry, and they handle it. And I think that's the tough part, is that it was a systematic thing of, this is how we do things. We don't handle this right. And that needs to be fixed throughout. And Tom Gallagher, the new president, is making the correct steps. He is making the changes needed and things like that. But there's just reasonable anger that, you know, there wasn't enough action taken.
The day that we're recording this, on the 17th, USA Today has another pretty explosive story. And Bruce and I talked about this on the podcast at the time, how you've got the athletic department, or the athletic department aspect of it. It's kind of like Baylor, where there's an athletic department aspect, but there's also a university administration aspect. And I thought this was a pretty jarring stat here. From the 2016-17 school year through the 2019-20 school year, LSU found 46 students responsible for Title IX offenses, which include rape, sexual assault, sexual harassment, dating and domestic violence, and stalking. And of those 46, just one was expelled, which is pretty horrifying to think about. So That demonstration I talked about, you know, I think that's probably just the beginning of this. And I also feel like, and we as college football writers obviously are central to this, why this happened. But I mean, the Les Miles stuff, they didn't go into that investigation. You tell me if I'm wrong. I don't think anybody went in there thinking that it was even going to involve Les Miles and sexual harassment. And that, so that ends [S2] True. [S1] Up becoming the news of it, right? Unfortunately, it ends up overshadowing all of these awful things that happened to these women who came forward with allegations. But at the end of the day, it just, I think the national championship coach, it turning out that there was an investigation into him 8 years ago, ended up kind of just blowing everybody away. I mean, was there any inkling among people? I know Ross, we talked about Ross Dellinger's column on this. Was there any inkling that that was going to end up being the I don't want to say legacy, but the biggest headline to come out of it in terms of in the sports world was something that, like you said, ended up leading to him getting fired at a different school?
No, and I think that's a great point, that it's almost telling of part of the, not the, I don't know if that's telling of the problem, but it's telling of something, like you're saying, that became the news, right? And it's like when something like this happens, there's almost this desire for like the juiciest thing to cling on to, and you want interesting names and all that, when in reality, yeah, the real problems aren't the gossip mag things to talk about. The real problems are how LSU was extremely underfunded in its, you know, in its Title IX department, and that pretty much nobody in the athletics department even knew who the Title IX officer was. You know, things like that. Those are the real problems. Then I don't think anyone was expecting Les Miles to be the focus of this thing, but he's the bigger name. And shoot, we're all guilty of it. I'm guilty of the fact that, yeah, I mean, one of the first things I posted on, you know, my Athletic Briefs page was that we uncovered that Joe Oliva actually did email, you know, the Board of Supervisors to have, you know, Les Miles fired in 2013. That was like the quick news I gravitated toward, when that shouldn't be the focus. That is not the important thing here. So I do think there's a little bit of surprise with that, and a little bit of almost like representing what the problem is, that we're not inclinated to focus on, hey, the victims and the Title IX issues and the fundamental things that need to be changed there. So, and yeah, there's a lot of work to do, and there's I think a long way to go. And I, like you said, I don't think this is going anywhere. USA Today and The Advocate and us, we are all still heavily looking into this. So it's going to be a long way, and it's going to be interesting to see also, you know, the Louisiana legislature basically had a big session where they just torched President Tom Galligan for his punishment. So you have them pushing on this too. So I just don't think this is over by any means.
Brody, one of the things I noticed just from following some old LSU football players, not that old, but guys who played in the, let's say, in the T-Bob era of Les Miles, you know, in the last, you know, dozen years or so, and more recently, had been pretty vocal, especially about Virge Ausberry's punishment or lack thereof. Do you think, from your read on the situation, being down in Louisiana and being connected to a lot of folks there, do you think there's any chance that if there was more pressure, whether it's student sit-ins or things like that, that they, and that may include the AD, Scott Woodward, would reverse the punishment that is handed down in light of the Hush Blackwell report?
I would, quite frankly, and I don't say this in a positive way or a negative way, I'd be quite surprised if anything else ended up happening. You know, there was a lot of, you know, like you said, there was all this attention in the last week or 10 days about that punishment. Tom Galligan said they're still looking at, you know, things. And then Scott Woodward went on the radio just yesterday morning, or maybe it was Monday morning, saying, nope, no more. There will be no more punishment for, you know, for Virge Ausberry. And of course, that's not just Scott Woodward's decision. Of course, the Board of Supervisors and other people could end up getting involved as this backlash gets worse. But everything I've seen so far just indicates Virge Ausberry is not going to get punished further. And, you know, I don't want to be some guy sitting here like asking someone to get fired. I don't know all the details, and that's not something I like to do. But it is it's just a very bad look that the two people, I should say, at the real center of this are not really seeing that much repercussion. And, I mean, there's another tricky layer to this, quite frankly, in that, I don't know, I'm trying to put this, you know, delicately, but the way that system was set up, and this is not a defense of either of his people, and I hope it never sounds like that, but they were doing what LSU wanted them to do. And that's the other part that's really upsetting to kind of wrap your head around is, and I'm not Joe Oliva, you know, was the one who set it up where everything got reported directly to these people. It was not supposed to go to Title IX. That started with Oliva, and it probably goes above Oliva. That's the frustrating part, is that the way they wanted it, Virge Ausberry and Miriam Seeger were quite frankly doing their job, which is sickening in its own way. And that's the more problematic thing that Hush Blackwell pointed out, that's the biggest change that needs to happen. But I think there's a little bit of how they view it in terms of, hey, we're not going to punish them for doing what we told them to do. And they were told not to, you know, how to handle these things how they did. Let's put it that way.
Oh, just one other thing on this, Brody. Sharon Lewis is a name a lot of LSU diehard football fans probably are familiar with. She went to LSU and has worked there, I want to say, in recruiting dating back to early on Nick Saban days of the early 2000s. You know, in that report, and again, I don't know how many of our listeners have actually followed it too closely, but you know, like to me, Shea's would be an interesting story, just in that she really took the brunt of a lot of dealing with this, especially going back to the Les Miles allegations and everything like that. For the listeners who may be familiar with her name, but can you kind of walk us through just where this stands with her? Because it seems like somebody who's just, you know, has really kind of been through the ringer in this from the inside as well.
Absolutely. And I'm actually really glad you brought her up, and I wish I brought her up earlier. And it's something that I actually have a story in the works on, is more on her situation. And yeah, like you said, I mean, she's one of the more beloved people in that building from everything I've ever gathered, and somebody who, like you said, has been there for nearly 20 years now. And she, I want to highlight a line that Scott Schneider, I believe, wrote from Hush Blackwell, and it was a great line. You know, us writers will notice it, but it's heartbreaking that he highlighted in the, you know, the whole scope of this investigation, only one person was ever actually punished, you know, before they did this investigation, was ever punished for not reporting something to the Title IX department. And that one person was Sharon Lewis, which is, they said, which is ironic because she's the only person who tried to report things properly. And that one is just a massive example of the issues there, that she was the one person who got punished. She basically got punished for trying to do it the right way, and that's not how LSU wanted to do it. So I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, I mean, it was her workers that were mainly, you know, her recruiting staffers and, you know, support staffers, students who were at the crux of the Les Miles investigation from 2013, and they were the ones who were the victims of that. That Les Miles was asking that they only wanted the attractive, big-boobed, blonde women, that, you know, I think that was the line in there. And they were the ones that he was, you know, asking to go to a hotel room and trying to kiss and putting in these uncomfortable situations, to the point that he was not allowed to speak to student workers one-on-one anymore. It was her workers, and she, you know, they told her about it, and they cried in her office, and she, you know, the way the report tells it, I should say, was heartbroken and went to Miriam Seeger, went to all these people, and basically nothing happened at first. And then she tried to go above them and basically got punished for that. And the department basically came down on her. And, you know, there's several instances in that report of Virge Osberry, for example, publicly scolding her and basically yelling at her and berating her for basically trying to make bigger deals of some of these Title IX instances. And yeah, so she's the person in this who, it got so bad that she, you know, had a quote unquote mental breakdown, they said in the report, and had to go to, you know, LSU paid mental health, you know, training because she was struggling. So yeah, I think she's kind of the tragic figure in all of this, and in the perfect example of how the system was set up, so that if you report, you got punished. And, you know, and I think, and she, granted, she's still in the department. She actually got a big promotion about a year or two ago to associate athletic director of football recruiting and alumni relations. So, you know, they have taken care of Sharon Lewis, but yeah, she is definitely the tragic figure there.
Well, my last thing would just be, and look, I am going to be the person that brings it back to Les Miles, because this is a college football podcast, and our listeners know his name well. And, I'm just curious what you think, like, how was he viewed by LSU fans before this, and what it becomes now? Because, you know, before the revelations that I think started maybe a few weeks ago, like, I think the first, you know, report that indicated something happened was that he had reached some sort of settlement with a student at some point. You know, LSU fans turned on him when he lost 21-0 to Alabama. And it was kind of a year, you know, several years erosion of support for him. But at the end of the day, I do think, even though he was fired, even though they won the national title after he left, like, that he was still, you tell me, like, a pretty revered figure there, or celebrated figure. And I can't imagine that's the case anymore.
No, that's a really good point. Yeah, he was kind of the wacky old grandpa still. I mean, yeah, they resented him for the last few years of the LSU era. There was anger about how he kind of butchered some of those teams and had them stuck in the Stone Age and all that. But yeah, he was still beloved as that grass-chewing, crazy, you know, wacky uncle or wacky grandpa. And I think there was that, like, he was a beloved figure in the grand scheme of things, despite their frustrations with him. And he was always going to go down on that. Everybody loved making, you know, jokes about his acting career and all that stuff. Like, he was beloved in that way, and I think now it's going to change the entire tone of that era and the way, you know, I wrote last summer a big story on 2007's team and how, you know, all of his crazy calls and all of his fourth quarters and his fake field goals and all of that, and like it represented how crazy it was, but it worked out. And now you're going to look back on those times and there's going to be a little different tone and a weirder tone when you talk about, you know, that crazy fake field goal or going for it on fourth down. I think it's going to be like, it's no longer wacky less. It's like, it's going to have a somber tone to it. It's going to be interesting to see how he ends up being remembered. But then I also say this with a lot of sadness and not happiness. History also shows that these things kind of blow over for a lot of these people and they end up being forgiven. And I'm not saying anyone should be written off for the rest of their life, but it does tend to go that way. So we'll see in 10 years how he's remembered.
On that point, Brody, we appreciate you joining us today on the Audible, and we encourage you guys, if you don't follow Brody, to follow him on Twitter. His Twitter handle is Brody A. Miller. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, that's good off the top of my head. Brody, we look forward to more of your stories from spring football, as well as more big picture stuff. Brody is, I think, as Stu said, or at least as Stu has said privately, is one of the best reporters we have at The Athletic. And we're not just saying that because he's on the podcast now joining us, but we do appreciate you. And Brody, if memory serves, you still have an LSU podcast that we have finagled under The Athletic umbrella. Is that not true?
Yes, yeah. Please listen to Hold That Podcast with myself and T-Bob Hebert. Absolutely. Thanks for the plug, Bruce.
No, you know what? I'm a huge T-Bob fan.
Teamwork? Yeah. I was going to say, it's people come for T-Bob.
Back in the days when we could still have events in person, you guys, we got to see a live version of that podcast in New Orleans for the Audible live show in the days before the national title game. That was fun.
Yeah, T-Bob thrives in those settings. Put him in a bar in New Orleans and he's going to kill it. Yeah.
All right, Brody, well, we really appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks, Brody.
All right, Bruce, what do you say we get to some emails?
Okay, let's do it.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. The first one is from Mark Weaver. The Big Ten had a tumultuous season with the fewest games played of the Power 5 outside of the Pac-12. And outside of Ohio State, the traditional powers of the last few years, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Penn State, struggled last season. They all have long-term head coaches, but with a lot of staff turnover. They all have returning QBs who have a lot of question marks. Which one of these three teams is best set up to bounce back from a frustrating 2020?
That's a good question. My guess is going to be Wisconsin, just because I feel like they are better positioned. They're in a more manageable division on top of that. You know, I feel like they had less of a staff overhaul. Now, they did lose the D-line coach to Vandy. They just lost their running back coach, John Settle, to Kentucky. But Michigan made big staff moves. Penn State, you know, it's maybe the fourth OC in 4 years or in 5 years. You go back, it was Moorhead, then it was Ricky Ronnie took back over, and then Kirk Shiraka, and now we have Mike Yurcich. That's a lot of turnover, right? So I'm going to say Wisconsin for that reason. I just feel like it's right now feels like it's the most stable situation, and it's in the most manageable side of the conference. You?
Yeah, same answer for me. Wisconsin was one of those teams where, as we look at the teams that had big COVID disruptions, some of them you just look at and say, I don't think we really learned anything about them last season. You know, Wisconsin had a mediocre season if you go by the record. But they also, I think we saw them at full strength for maybe one game. I think Jalen Berger had the makings of being the next great Wisconsin running back. We only saw him for a few games. We only saw Graham Mertz play with his top receivers for a couple games. So I would expect them to bounce back in a pretty big way. I mean, it's obviously a program that you basically count on most years to win 9 or 10 games. So I would think we'll see something more like that. I would not be surprised if Penn State bounces back in a big way, because that's another team that had some very unusual circumstances. We've talked about it on here before. that contributed to that 0-5 start. And then Michigan, to me, is the wild card. Their season ended after six games last year. Wasn't going well at all. There wasn't a lot of reason for optimism, but early returns on his new coaching staff are good. So, important transfers coming in. Alan Bowman could end up being that quarterback there. So I'm not ready to sit here and say like that they would have the biggest bounce back, but I'm also not ruling it
out. Let me ask you this, Stu, while we're talking about bounce back potential teams, I want to ask you about where you are with Minnesota, right? So 2 years ago, PJ Fleck had a terrific season. They finished 10th in the country. They were 11-2. Last year, with the pandemic, they also had staff change and new offensive coordinator. Kirk Ciarrocca left to go to Penn State. Mike Sanford Jr. came in. They were bad. They were 3-4. Do you think that was it? Which do you think Minnesota is? Do you think Minnesota is the team that is a top 15 caliber team like they were in 2019? Or do you think they're the team that, honestly, in the other, you know, the years around it, they were 3-6 in the Big Ten in 2018, 3-4 last year? What do you think they're closer to?
Is there an option C? Is there somewhere in between answer? Because I think that probably that 2019 10-win season was, the ceiling, like the best of Minnesota. And then I think, again, like, you just, they lost. Well, the problem last year was their defense was just horrible. And it was an inexperienced defense to begin with. And then, you know, like with a lot of teams, right? What happens when you have no spring, when you have an inexperienced team that has no spring practice? I mean, it's pretty embarrassing to look back at, you know, Michigan scored 49 on them in the opener, didn't do that, anything close to that to anybody else. And then their season gets disrupted four games in, and we just, you'll never know, like, what might have happened to that team. So they did, in their last two games, they gave up 17 points to Nebraska and 2017 in overtime to Wisconsin. So it does seem like they were getting better by the end. So I would expect them to go back to being at least
top
like
20 team,
7-5. I'm going to say 7-5, 8-4 kind of team. And then, I don't know, what do you, it sounds like you're hinting that you think they're going to be right back in the top 15.
I'm not. Tanner Morgan, the quarterback who was there in 2019, he's still there. I'm not, I don't know. I wouldn't go that far. I think they're probably a 6-6, 7-5 kind of team. I don't think, like, I guess kind of what you're intimating, I don't know if I see the 8-4 part, but I think they are probably closer to the middle than either one of those years that they had where they're, you know, whatever, 3-6 or 3-5 in the Big Ten as opposed to 7-2 or something like that. I think they're probably of a 5-4, 4-5 kind of team in the league.
I feel like there's always going to be a little skepticism about PJ Fleck because he's such an unusual personality. But like, he's done it at two different places now. Like, the guy can coach. And so I expect him to be good under him. How good? I don't know. Like, will that turn out to be a one-time deal that season? I don't know. But I think last year, I guess I'm willing to give him a pass for last year. It's going to be funny because, like, pretty much any coach in the country that had a bad season last year, I've been like, that was COVID disrupted. I'm like, you can't really read anything into that. But, of course, they're not all going to bounce back next year. Some of them will be bad again. We'll just have to see which ones.
Next question is from David Eisen. After several years in which players have opted out of bowl games, we had numerous teams opting out of this past season. Was this a one-year COVID aberration, or do you think this is something we'll see becoming relatively routine among Power 5 teams who do not make New Year's Six bowls? After all, don't lots of schools actually lose money on many of the bowl games? Is this the end of bowls as we knew and loved them? Thanks and keep up the great work, David. This is a good question, Stu. You're Mr. Bowl Projections guy. You're the guy who's in the weeds on some of these things, talking to the bowl execs. You think David's onto something?
I think that it was a pretty unique set of circumstances, and teams that did that had already been through 3-4 months of trying to play college football during COVID and everything that entailed, and then looking at the prospect of spending Christmas in a hotel room eating a boxed lunch, kind of what we're hearing about this NCAA tournament bubble, by the way, what their experience is like right now. No, let's go home and be with our families for the first time since summer. So that led to lots and lots and lots of schools opting out to the point where games got canceled. I don't see that happening again. It's going to be hopefully back to you get to go there for a week and go to all these activities and all that stuff. Could there be, like, I guess the possible exception could be this has happened. I remember this happened. Notre Dame turned down a bowl invite the year they fired Charlie Weiss. Like maybe a team with a coaching change said, you know, had a bad year but still qualifies for a bowl and fires their coach, could say, yeah, we're just going to pack it in. But I think most players want to go to games, to bowl games. It's a fun experience. And the point about losing money, I think that's only true probably of like the group of five low-end bowls. It's just like creative accounting. Let's say, I don't know, I mean, here, Auburn goes to the Outback Bowl and has to, you know, buy a bunch of tickets. Technically, Auburn may spend more than that bowl pays out. However, everybody in the SEC gets a cut of the SEC's collective bowl revenue, including playoff revenue. They all make lots and lots of money from that. So whether your own individual school made money off, I mean, whether your school made money off its own bowl trip, kind of doesn't matter in the end, because you're still going to make all this SEC bowl money, even if you didn't play in a bowl game.
Okay, very good answer, Stu. Let's go quickly off of our main sport. This question is from Brian in the South Bay. I know this is a football podcast, but since it's the season, who do you like in this year's tourney? And what's the one shining moment from past tournaments that you remember most fondly?
I can't believe we went this long into the podcast without bringing up March Madness. It's here.
Well, considering neither one of us has probably watched much college basketball this year, it's probably not a stretch that we're...
I noticed that Andy and Ari did a, you know, idiot's guide to the two guys who haven't watched any college basketball talk NCAA bracket. We weren't going to do that for a full episode, but of the college basketball I watched, and I probably watched more of it in the, like, starting the week before the conference tournaments through, Gonzaga seems to me to be head and shoulders above everybody else. I know people like Illinois, I know they like Michigan, etc., but like, man, Gonzaga is dominant, and it just feels like it's been building toward, like, he's one of those programs that they've been close, they're going to do it eventually. And I've got plenty of one shining moments, but first, who's your NCAA tournament pick?
You know what? I'm going to go with Illinois, in part because I watched them early in the year, and I remember texting somebody on their football staff and be like, hey, your center, you know, did anybody ever look at him at a left tackle? And this conversation was like, I think I poked the bear too much on some of this, where it was like, you know, if they ever heard that we were asking about that kid to play football, we'd probably get in a lot of trouble. I will go with Illinois. I don't know, for sentimental reasons, I have a connection to the school anyway. So that will be that's my pick for no other reason.
Okay, one shiny moments. Where do we start? I mean, for me, so I used to cover the NCAA tournament every year, and the it's kind of the luck of the bracket. Like some years you end up at many years I ended up, especially once I moved west and would get sent to San Diego or Sacramento, it just seemed like nothing ever happened at those sites. But way back when, I had the good fortune of being assigned to the region in D.C. where George Mason knocked off number one UConn to reach the Final Four. And that was before Wichita State, Loyola, Butler, VCU. Like, they were the first of those mid-majors to do it. And it was just such a colossal upset. I can't even begin to quantify it. UConn had, I think their whole starting lineup was first round picks, or maybe four of the five. Rudy Gay was on that team. And a bunch of guys that barely went on to play any professional basketball, much less in the NBA, knocked them off to go to the Final Four. So it was just really, really cool to be there for that. But certainly I've enjoyed plenty more on TV. Do you have a favorite?
It's weird. As you're saying this, I mean, I have some memories that really stand out of covering the tournament. They wouldn't fit in the category of one shining moment. You know, I'm just thinking of certain things that I kind of was around. You know, like I was at a game, and I'm trying to remember. I think it was in Salt Lake City. It was a first weekend back and forth game between, I want to say it was Arizona and Gonzaga. It was a wild, like, yeah. And I want to say it was the second round. And it was one of the best games I've ever seen in person, right? And it was just like, it felt like both teams were just, you know, I feel like it was at the ascension of Gonzaga where, you know, obviously it wasn't when the John Stockton ascension, but it was like, okay, we know this is a good program, you know, because I saw Butler before they really kind of broke out. I think I was at the Kemper Arena. It was so long ago that I think it was the first time. I have a buddy who works at ESPN whose like best friend was Wright Thompson, and Wright was covering the tournament. Maybe for the Times Picayune, I don't even know for who, maybe the Kansas City Star or whatever, but it was like that long ago, you know, where it was like, I think he was like 2 years out of college. You know, it was like, I had heard of Butler, but I didn't, you know, it wasn't like Butler is what it became like 10 years later. And so for me, some of these memories are just like, I covered it so long ago. I just think about like what those programs, you know, what their program's profile was back then. It's a little surreal to see. You know, I watched the, I think it was Gonzaga BYU game the other night, and it's just like, it's over the course of that game. I think at one point they showed like the Naismith Award, either finalists or something. And it was like everybody had one player, and I think there were three guys from the Zags on there. You know, it was just to show the depths of the team. And it's just like, wow, this is my how times have changed.
You know, I think I mentioned this in terms of college football memories recently, but I'm same thing with college basketball, where I can vividly remember Bryce Drew or Christian Laettner, or let's go a little bit more recent than that. I was at the Butler Duke national title game where Butler almost hit that ridiculous half court shot to win. I can remember all that. But like Richard Deitch's March Madness viewers guide this week began with an anecdote about the 2019 Virginia Purdue overtime classic. I know I watched that game. I don't remember it. It was 2 years ago. I don't remember anything about that game. I'm sure I was watching it. And yet I remember all these, not even classic, just like games that I happened to be at or see on TV many years ago that just like have, remember the crazy game? This was probably like 5 years ago. It was 5 years ago, I know, because my daughter was a baby and I was trying to watch March Madness while taking care of a baby. And Texas A&M came back from, they were down like 11 points to Northern Iowa with, I want to say like 30 seconds left, and came back and won.
I'll be honest, I cannot say I remember any of that. I don't.
See, same thing. It's like, there's got to be like an academic type who listens to this podcast who studies this for a living. What is it with the phenomenon where you can remember obscure moments in sports from your past, but you can't remember something from 1 year ago or 2 years ago?
Like, I remembered something from a long, long time ago. I was a Louisville fan before I was like probably even in middle school. You know, I remembered one of the first college basketball teams I remember was Daryl Griffith's team, and Denny Crum was the head coach. And I want to say the year after they won the national title, like 40 would totally remember this, but I'm not sure many of our listeners are old enough to remember it. But I think it was the year after Louisville won the tournament, they played Arkansas, and Arkansas had a guard named U.S. Reed, U.S. Reed. And I'm almost positive, and maybe like I was sitting on the floor, this is way before DVR stuff or anything like that, like U.S. Reed hit like a 45-foot shot, I think, to win the game. Now maybe the game was tied. I don't remember exact circumstances, but I was like, holy shit, this is unreal that I just happened to see this real time or whatever. And it was like, you're kind of conflicted where the team I wanted to win lost, but the way they lost was just, at least as I remember the situation, was just amazing circumstance, you know? Like I remember Danny Ainge as a little kid have this half, you know, full court end to end, you know, layup, driving layup to beat Notre Dame and Digger Phelps 1 year. You know, it's just like, so I remember some of the moments, but I can't say the context around them are a little hazier. And I feel like I remember some of those things when there was a more of a novelty aspect of it to, you know, to otherwise. Now I remember stuff around the tournament probably better, especially if I was covering it that way.
I also remember, so I've always said that covering the NCAA tournament, it's, I would much rather watch the, I'd much rather be at the college football national championship game than watch it on TV. It's the opposite for the tournament. Like the tournament is, especially the early rounds, like it's a TV event. You want to be able to switch between the various different games. That being said, I remember a lot of my like trips and, you know, travel and hanging out. And so I'm going to bring one up that you were there for, this story. You might not want me to tell it.
Oh, by the way, I got a story you're not going to want me to tell from the NCAA tournament.
All right, let's trade notes.
It happened on the trolley in the Midwest. Let's just say that.
Trolley?
We got on a trolley to go to media availability.
Whatever it is, don't tell it. Okay. This one doesn't implicate you in any way. You were there for it. So I just remember that we were in Austin for the regional in 2005. And the reason I remember it was that year was because our media friends, John Bianco, Jeremy Sharp at Texas set it up.
Did this involve Salim Stoudemire indirectly? I remember this moment actually too, what you're going to say.
So we were there and like they set up a session while we were in town for the Bethlehems to interview Mac Brown. And while we were interviewing Mac Brown, like, oh, hey, look, it's Vince Young strolling. He just happens to be strolling through the room. Hey, Vince, come meet these reporters. As in, I don't think that was a coincidence. But anyway, yeah, we were at a sports bar watching the Sweet 16 games at the other sites. And Duke was at our site. And we're watching Arizona and Salim Stoudemire, you know, great three-point shooter, tearing it up. And one of our buddies gets into like a heated argument with the Duke SID about, he says Salim Stoudemire is a better shooter than J.J. Redick, and the Duke SID is going back at him. Like, it got kind of nasty.
It definitely got really awkward, yeah, because I think the guy in question, who was the Salim guy, had written a story about him and had spent a bunch of time around him and really liked Salim Stoudemire. And that, yeah, I definitely remember that.
Do you have any stories like that that are safe for the podcast? I thought you were going to, when you started, I thought you were going to bring up my driving.
No. Ooh, you know what? I don't even know if I want to say this, because I remember being
2007 Atlanta.
I just remember being with you in a car and Pete Thamel, and I don't remember the fourth person, and somebody asking me, because you had scared them so much driving, they were like, Bruce, do you think are you over the legal limit, or do you think you could take over? I definitely remember, and I was like, there's no way I'm legally, you know, able to do this. So we just wrote it out with you, without any drinks, but just,
I think you were in the car behind me. That's the thing. There was a car following us, and yeah, I didn't know where I was going. I was lost. So I kind of maybe abruptly stopped at some point or made an abrupt turn. And like, then you guys called us and you're like, is Stu drunk driving? What's going on up there? And that probably would have been a better explanation.
Have I ever told you this story? So, like, it was one of the last years I covered the tournament. It's definitely one of the last years I did write college basketball for ESPN Magazine. So, the year, I want to say it was like mid-2000s, and it was Illinois had a loaded team. Bruce Weber was still the coach. It was D. Brown, Darren Williams, Luther Head team. They were undefeated for much of the year. And so, myself and two other ESPN Magazine people spent the week embedded with them. And so we got to know those guys way better than, and I'm just talking about the team, like everybody around the team, including some of the managers and everything. Anyway, about a month or so after the story ran, they were playing, again, I don't know if it was Kansas City or St. Louis, I forget which, but it was a Marvin Williams UNC team. And that back in the day, I remember I was part of a points pool as well as, you know, I had a bracket with a lot of my ESPN colleagues. And we had figured out that if North Carolina beat Illinois in the title game, I would win like $900. And if they didn't, I'd win like nothing or whatever, the way it just was going to break. Anyway, before the game, I saw like the head manager at Illinois, who I had, you know, gotten to know that week. And I'm a little superstitious. And at one point, as we had a nice conversation, and I said to him, normally, I think I just out of habit, I would have said, hey, good luck, Matt. Instead, I was like, I said, well, hope you have a good time tonight, Matt. And I just kind of walked away because I didn't want to say good luck. Because if I said good luck, you know, I mean, and I liked Bruce Weber. He was good to us and all those guys. But it was like, hey, I got $900 to win. And anyway, Illinois, I think, ended up losing maybe by 10 or whatever. I don't know if the game was ever that much in doubt. But I that was one of the last games I covered, I remember, was that Illinois-North Carolina national title game there.
See, what you just said was like an example of like why sports writers shouldn't bet on sports. But
I wasn't really betting on sports. I was in a pool, yeah.
Yeah, I don't count entering NCAA tournament bracket pools as betting. But that was a pretty high stakes one you went in. I remember at the Final Four in 2010, that the Duke-Butler one I just mentioned, my buddy who's a Duke fan was there, and he had entered a pool that so many people enter it, you know, that the winner can end up winning like a couple, you know, you put $5 in, you can end up winning $2,000. And it had reached a point where if Duke won, he was going to win the whole thing. And if they lost, it, kind of like what you just described, like the difference between first place and third place was considerable. So he was on he was on the phone with the person who was in second place trying to negotiate some sort of settlement. Like, why don't we just split the money right now? I don't remember. I don't even remember if he got him to do that or not. But I hope you guys enjoy your. I think it's a good spot to end on. I hope you guys enjoy. I mean, me personally, I'm just like so grateful to have March Madness back after last year. It was so. I know there were much more important ramifications of COVID, but that was the moment for all of us where like, oh my gosh, the NCAA tournament is canceled. This is awful. I can't believe it's come to this. And little did we know what the next year was going to be like, but glad to have it back, even if it's kind of this weird bubble and they're playing on different days than they usually do and they're all on one site and whatnot. I think come Friday, it'll feel great. And good luck to everybody in their pools. Don't use our advice, that's for sure.
Amen to that.
Send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time. Thank you.